This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. This week on the program, we bring you a forum that looks at the distressed rural economies in Utah, the economic and geographic challenges that tend to constrain their growth, and what these rural communities can do to revive their economies. Challenges facing rural Utah include population decline, stimulated by limited opportunities for jobs and career development, often forcing families to break apart as members graduating high school leave their rural communities for better economic opportunities in urban areas of the state. In July, during the National Governors Association summer meeting held in Salt Lake City, Governor Herbert laid out his goal of 25,000 new jobs in rural Utah by 2020, claiming the state was on target with 20,000 jobs already in place. To potentially close the gap, the creation of the Chamber Rural Workforce Network was announced this month at the Utah Rural Summit in a partnership between the Salt Lake Chamber, the Department of Workforce Services, and the Economic Development Corporation of Utah. The Chamber Rural Workforce Network will seek to address the employment problems and geographic limitations of rural Utah by connecting employers with rural labor markets, bringing economic opportunities that are usually limited to the Wasatch Front, where 80% of current Utah jobs reside. Speaking on the panel is Ginger Chin, Managing Director of Urban and Rural Business Services for the Governor's Office of Economic Development, Sean Milne, Commissioner of Tooele County, Nick Tatton, Community Director of Price City, and moderating the discussion is Teresa Foxley, President and CEO of the Economic Development Corporation of Utah. This week's forum was recorded on February 25th, 2019. Here is your moderator, Teresa Foxley.
So again, to get back to the what's happening nationally, really what we've seen and what economists have observed since the Great Recession is what we would call a big divergence in economies. So the top 2% of U.S. communities, based on measures of growth and wages, began to consistently grow faster than the median and least populated sized cities following the Great Recession. This economic performance by communities' size has created what we call a new economic hierarchy. Large metros, so those metros with over a million people or more, have accounted for 72% of employment growth since the financial crisis. Most economists would attribute this to what's known as agglomeration, and this is where firms tend to cluster around areas of specialization, and especially where there's workforce specialization. So this is one of the reasons why the state has adopted a cluster or a focus industry, focus sector approach, which is to try and develop out some of that agglomeration and try to enhance that. But a firm might choose to locate somewhere where they believe there's already a lot of dense labor, dense talent, and those firms then, the people circulate throughout those firms, capital tends to circulate throughout those firms, and it's really been something that we've noticed, especially over the last 10 years. But this effect, this divergent effect, has led to some major social issues, where we now have nearly 50 million Americans living in what would be considered distressed economies. And think about that. The population of this country is about 320 million. So a significant number of our American civilians are living in distressed economies. And that has led to a whole host of social issues, including shorter life expectancies, deaths of despair, and other really challenging social issues. Now, I know we're sitting here in the Hinckley Institute of Politics, so certainly we want to talk a little bit about some of the political implications as well. And I think some of those political consequences were observed in 2016 during a national election with President Donald Trump winning many rural counties throughout America that were historically toss-up or Democrat. So those voters were perceived to have been endorsing an American First agenda in response to some job loss. So just as there appear to be two Americas, there are also, we would say, two Utahs as well, or really two or more Utahs. So there are 29 counties in the state of Utah. Utah, Salt Lake, Davis, and Weber counties make up the Wasatch Front, and about 80% of the state's 3 million population resides along that Wasatch Front. A lot of people think of the remaining 25 counties as rural. However, I believe to do so paints all of those counties with far too broad of a brush, and it's a mischaracterization. Of the 25 non-Wasatch Front counties, It's really 11 counties in Utah that have contracted since the fourth quarter of 2007. Some of those rural counties have unemployment rates in excess of 6.5%. Those counties have an aging population. Those counties have experienced net out migration. So if you look at the Wasatch Front, there's been high net in-migration, which creates what I consider to be a flywheel effect in the economy. You have people moving in, which creates corporate investment, which creates a good job market, which leads to more people moving into our economy. However, in some of our rural economies, we know that there's net out-migration. However, of those 14 remaining quote-unquote rural counties, many are actually at stasis or they're experiencing growth. Tooele County, represented here today, had economic growth of around 2% in 2018, if we adjust for some data anomalies, and has a 3.6% unemployment rate today. Most economists consider a 4% unemployment rate full employment. Carbon County has actually experienced a 4.9% growth, which was led by the mining sector in 2018, but still has a 4.4% unemployment rate. I would note this is down from a 9% unemployment rate at its peak in 2010. So with that stage being set, let's move directly into, and I really want now our panelists to take over this conversation, but why some of our rural economies in the state of Utah are stressed, why some are thriving, and what, if anything, we can do to create a more inclusive economy in Utah. So let's just start there. Toss this out to the entire set of panelists, but why are some of our rural economies struggling? How do they compare to our national economies?
You know, it's interesting because when you look across the United States, it's hard to say that we're all kind of in the same shape, because you cannot compare Vermont to California. You're going to look at way different economic conditions completely. And the state of Utah is exactly like that. When Teresa was mentioning 25 counties that are considered semi, not all of them completely rural, but I mean, we'll just say for the sake of this conversation that we've got 25 rural counties. If you're looking at those counties, there's such a difference from Daggett County to Tooele County, to Grand County. It's almost as if they're independent states all on their own. And to say that some of the economies are struggling, they vary from county to county. Some are very seasonally based. They have tourism in the peak seasons. And then when the tourists go back home during the winter, when things get cold, it changes up the economy of that community. Some are mining based or coal country based. And so that's gonna make some changes. And they struggle because sometimes people want to keep rural. You know, people move to these communities for a reason. They move to the small, they want a quality of life that provides not a lot of traffic, not a lot of congestion. And so a lot of communities, they say, well, we don't want a lot of growth. We don't want a lot of big businesses come in. But then on the flip side to that, they say, you know, we hear communities all the time say, we don't want to export our children. Our number one export are our kids, because they'll go to high school and when they're ready to go, they'll go to college, and some of them don't come back. Many of our rural economies, they want high-paying jobs, but they want just enough jobs so that their kids don't leave. So that it's complex. To answer Teresa's question on why our rural communities are struggling, is they're all different. There's some complexities to every community, and different communities have different needs, and there's not one panacea that is a cure-all for the rural economies. And that's why I think even not only the state of Utah, but when I'm talking to my counterparts in different parts of the nation, they have the same struggles, because there's just not one cure-all for rural communities.
I would agree with that absolutely. Whether you're a pro-Obama administration or Trump administration, you know, you're going to see a shift in what you think is the most appropriate way to cure a problem. And so it is with self-determination. I'll bet a lot of you probably differ in your perspective than that of your parents. And you want self-determination to be able to determine for yourself what to do when you grow up. Some of you, it might even be different than what your parents had in store for you 10 years ago, right? And so it is with local communities or jurisdictions. And to a greater or lesser extent, depending upon some of it being partisanship, although I would dare say not much of it is partisanship, some of it has to do with access to capital, which Teresa mentioned. Some of it has to do with access to a skilled workforce. which Ginger could definitely speak well to. Some of it has to do with geography and our relative nature to the metro area. So I probably have an advantage representing a jurisdiction right next door to the Wasatch Front than, say, Carbon County, right, or Price. So it is definitely complex, and it definitely matters depending upon the area. That said, I'm grateful for the work that these two ladies do. And by the way, they're too humble to say it for themselves. And I know that Gabby kind of introduced Teresa this way, but we have very little idea just how awesome these women are for the two entities that they represent. And even though it's not the purpose of this, coming off of the celebration of Hughes for her giving, you know, Utah women the first right to vote, I think it deserves to be recognized that when we're collaborative and when we look outside of the status quo sometimes, this is the benefit of a good economy too, is innovation. And these women represent two organizations that I couldn't do my job with without them. So whether it's Governor's Office of Economic Development or GOED that Ginger represents or Teresa with EDC Utah, I will say that, and maybe there's a more fitting question, so I don't want to get too much off you know, this particular one you just asked, Teresa, but innovation and the ability to work cohesively with other agencies. So if there's another more fitting question, I'll save my response there. But why we are struggling to some degree, I think is because as complicated as it is, and humans, we love black and white, you know, soundbite answers in 140 characters or less, but it's not that simple. That's like trying to describe each one of you to say you're either the same or different than anybody else in the room at 140 characters or less. And that's probably not fair to you as an individual. So it is definitely a complex answer.
Thank you. I echo all the sentiment. I would say a challenge a rural area has, a thought that came to my mind is we have seen the enemy and he is us. And we tend to be our own worst enemy. My area is steeped in tradition with energy, mining, power plants, a workforce that gets up very, very early, packs its lunchbox and goes to work and works real hard in a high labor environment and comes home. And that really isn't the case anymore. And there's a mindset that is the case still, and it's a smaller part of the economy than it used to be, but it's still the mindset. So sometimes we need to understand who we are and where we're at a given time. It's not the same economy. It's not the same workforce as it was years ago. I think some of the other, you mentioned Grand County and tourism, an economy that was largely based on uranium years and years ago and successfully transferred to a tourism-based economy. And they may have seen the enemy, and it could be them, that you can't find a hotel room for a reasonable price, and the workers can't afford to live there, and they have to work many miles, hours, bad roads away to be there. Another thing you mentioned was geography. And I think geography has, physical barriers have some limitations. In our little area, is anybody familiar with Price in that area? Okay. In our little area, we have a saying that it's only 8 miles from Helper to Price, but it's 80 miles from Price to Helper. And I think that same thing happens with the metro area. Well, you know, we're only 65 miles from Spanish Fork in the Provo area, but people think, you know, going the other way, that it's 150 miles, that it's further than it is. We were chatting earlier about the drive really isn't that bad. And so sometimes I think that geography plays into it in terms of a perception more than a reality.
That's Nick Tatton, Community Director of Price City. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today we are airing a panel discussion on reviving rural economies in Utah. Here again is moderator Teresa Foxley.
Well, very interesting comments from everyone. I appreciate that. And so I think now the stage is sort of set for why some economies in Utah are doing better than others. But let's really get to the heart of why we're here today, which is to discuss how struggling rural areas can revive their economies. Nick, I failed to introduce in our intro that Nick is part of what's called the Coal Country Task Force. So some very innovative solutions around how we can transition some of our resource-based economies into new areas. And some very innovative things going on in Tooele County, transitioning from military installations and defense into other parts of the economy. So I'd love Nick and Commissioner Milne to start off with this topic.
Okay. Yeah, for those of you who haven't heard, the Utah Coal Country Strike Team is the brainchild of some of this university's folks. And we took a look at our community, the Carbon and Emery County area, and said, wow, what happens when all this energy and all this mining is done? You know, the lights still have to be on, but there's less and less of it that's traditional coal mines and power plant based. And it's you mentioned the defense area. It's the equivalent of having Hill Air Force Base shut down, right in that area. And so with all that pressure on the economy, The idea is that we have to change our mindset, the perception. There's several legs to that mindset change. One is a state emphasis, and in a rural area, you mentioned, I'm sure you've heard it there, say, what are they doing for us? What are they doing for us? What are they doing for it? Well, they is us. They is here today. What are we doing for ourselves? And part of that is how to structure incentives for businesses and people to live in a rural area if they want to and be competitive. There's a great effort with some home-based business incentives. And one of the challenges we have is that if you want to base your business in a rural area, from a state perspective, all the incentives are the same throughout the state, but every area is a little different. We also have some of the oldest housing stock, the immigrants and the folks that settled the area and began that industrial age in this area. Those homes are hundreds of years old, and a lot of them have been fixed up pretty nice, but a lot of them are pretty ratty. And so there needs to be an improvement to the housing stock to maintain value in the community. And then there's also, of course, a tourism orientation that our area can take advantage of. It hasn't really realized over time, as well as some technology. And if you help me spread the word that there's going to be Silicon Slopes East, and that'll be a real boon for our economy and our area, and to keep kids home, keep from exporting some of our brightest folks to other areas.
I've had the opportunity to know Ginger and Teresa for a couple of years, but I've just met Nick, and I have a feeling Nick and I, we speak the same language. Sometimes telling a community, excellent. And I can definitely attest to this in politics. It can be a little squirrely to look a constituency group in the face and say, you have got to change. Nobody likes to hear that from their elected leaders because we work for you, right? It's not the other way around. And I firmly believe that last part. But sometimes, especially if this is a full-time job to be a government bureaucrat, I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, you become educated in a way you didn't see when you were on the other side of the fence. And I got to say that and admit it. It's almost like my mea culpa as a private sector guy. Because I've learned the citizens don't really care for when you have to look back at the Chamber of Commerce or some policymakers in your decision or your position and say, we can no longer be who we used to be because that economy doesn't exist anymore. Or it's waning. But along those lines, I see how interconnected we are. And that's what I've loved about my current job. I was a part-time city council person before this. And as referenced, 20 years plus, I've owned my own business. And it was pretty easy to see the world in a silo and think that my experience was the only right experience to have. But something, there have been a couple things Nick has said that I totally love. And I think that this is the key to how we increase economic opportunity in the rural area. We've got to start seeing how interconnected we are. And I think that for, without incriminating anybody else up here, I've been alive long enough to remember before the internet and certainly before a smartphone. Yeah. And you are blessed if you're young enough to not know when landlines were the only way to contact somebody else, because you're proof that we're more interconnected, but we just don't see it and we take it for granted. Nick mentioned Grand County and mining of uranium. Oddly enough, Tooele County is connected to that economically, because they used to mine uranium there, and an off product was called depleted uranium. And this is topical because there's House Bill 220 right now during the legislative session, and I've been a proponent of it for my county. And to just show this rural economy and how this all plays in, what was a byproduct that they were not a fan of decades ago, about 30 years ago now, the state and the Fed said it shall come to Tooele County. And my predecessors, before I even lived here in Utah, said we don't want it, for probably many of the same reasons other folks along the Wasatch Front say they don't want it. And so what was seen as a negative to Grand County and a community there was also at the time seen as a negative in my county. Now we see it as a positive. And we're connected in that economic benefit. So I say that to make it connect to the military, because we've housed some admittedly dangerous elements in Tooele County, which is larger than three states in the Union, by the way, just that one county. And this has been vitally important to my economy. And I moved in, having grown up in another state where it's a little bit more left-leaning than Utah. And I kind of railed against it when I became an elected leader. And certain constituents came forward and said, hey, you need to stop talking bad about us. We're proud of what we've done. And Nick kind of alluded to it with coal country. Sometimes, unexpectedly, we become really good in a niche, and we have to appreciate that someone else may not like X, but benefits from the positive of X. Like, we all benefit from cheap electricity because of coal. We all benefit from safe X-ray technicians at our dentist's office, or other things that, as a consequence of society, may find a final resting place in Tooele County, Utah, but that's important to our economy. So we have found something that, even though we came kicking and screaming once upon a time, we're good at it now, and we're safe, and my citizens are proud of that safety record. And so it's kind of like a cluster that Ginger and Teresa have alluded to. Like, that's our cluster, and we own it, and we're very proud of it. And for us, it doesn't have to be what Salt Lake County likes right next door, but for us, it's important, and we're good at it. Our nation has better environmental protections than another nation might, and so this idea that it belongs somewhere else perhaps may actually be worse for the interconnectivity of the globe as well. So I know that you were kind of setting me up for Deseret UAS and maybe the racetrack and some other things, but it's right along those lines. Tooele County has had to reinvent itself several times in the last 50 years. I mean, they went from being a mining town like Carbon County to seeing that disfavorably, you know, again, culturally, and some economic effects that made it more cost effective to go do those activities in some other nation. But we lost American jobs as a result of it, right? We lost American oversight of environmental practices as a result of it. But we reinvented ourselves nonetheless, and it became driven upon military. We have Dugway Proving Grounds, and we have two different campuses of Tooele Army Depot separated 10 miles apart. And then we were subject to BRAC, base relocation and closure. Just what Nick said, it was the equivalent of Hill Air Force Base going away. In two different installations, we lost over 3,000 jobs a year across a couple of years, but at two different installations, we lost over 3,000 jobs. That's a big hit for us. So we've had to reinvent ourselves. And assuming that there's an opportunity to talk about Deseret UAS and how we're riding the coattails of state-identified clusters so that in our limited resources of cash and time and personnel at the government level, rather than try to go out and be the tip of the spear, we're further back on that edge. We're still part of the spear, but we're able to work collectively, cooperatively with the entities these two ladies represent. And I'm happy to expand on that with a subsequent answer so that I don't capitalize too much on this
one. Well, yeah, why don't we move into that, actually? Because I think, you know, we wanted to discuss some green shoots that we are seeing in rural economies. I think you hit on an excellent point, which is most economies thrive when they do specialize in something, right? And in our world, or at least at the EDC that I represent, our whole job really is to research and understand what comparative advantages exist and then market that and get that information into the hands of the right people. And Tooele County has done that, I think, phenomenally well with Deseret UAS. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about that.
Perfect. So before I go into that, Ginger, do you want to take a moment to identify the clusters and let these fine folks understand why I'm going to use that to talk about Deseret UAS?
So under the governor's direction, there are 6 economic development clusters in the state of Utah. So energy being one, and outdoor recreation, financial services, which is ironically our largest cluster, aerospace and defense to the north. I mean, we have a lot of aerospace and defense presence. IT, we talked about Silicon Slopes, IT, and then life sciences. And a lot of that is centered around the Salt Lake area.
Perfect. So a few years ago, without going into too much history, again, I don't want to capitalize on all the time or dominate too much of the time here, but these clusters, Tooele County, I came on board and we were in the middle of a budget, a need for a budget overhaul. We had a pretty severe problem with diminishing revenues from that waste management sector that I just spoke fondly about a moment ago. We were much more dependent upon that sector just a few years ago when I got into office. And between some outside influencing, certain entities came to us and said, hey, you know what? This is a bit of a downer when we go do some corporate recruitment for the state to say that this is just outside the metro area. Be a little sensitive to that. And of course, we kind of got our hackles raised and we're like, now, wait a minute. We're not your backyard, that's our own yard, but that's kind of a separate policy conversation that went on. But we recognized, okay, we might need to look at between some vertical integration that shrunk the amount of tonnage of those waste streams that were buried in our county because we get monies based upon tonnage. So just some smart corporate practices, the amount of revenue was shrinking, and we were also being advised by external parties that, hey, you might want to wean yourself off of this. Stop being so dependent upon that. The challenge is what that means functionally for a politician is the money I'm getting from somewhere, I've got to go find somewhere else. Because if my population's growing, I can't simply say I'm going to have fewer services with the same budget, right? Because I have to cut parks and rec. I have to cut public safety. I have to cut that money that's not coming in from an existing source and go find it somewhere else. Well, as a politician, I only have one thing that I can really govern, taxes and fees. And those are hard conversations to bring up with taxpayers, especially as a Republican that advocated, like Bush Sr., read my lips, no new taxes. I said, I'd rather tighten our belts than raise your taxes. And then I got into office, realized the situation a little bit more fully and went, oh, whew, oops, that was tough. And so I literally have had to have the difficult conversation with taxpayers, say, I'm going to raise your taxes because these kind of projects and fundamental economic shifts don't happen overnight. They don't even happen within one budget cycle of a year. So I had some conversations with some folks smarter than me, which is a plug for, you know, find in your cohorts right now while you're in school, folks like Teresa and Ginger, and like find those folks that are smarter than you that help elevate. Because I would work with folks like Nick to, you know, regional partners to state agencies. And I recognized these clusters and said, okay, rather than invent something I don't have the money to invent and to go out and be that tip of the spear, how can I draft behind somebody else? Now, if you're a racing fan, you'll get that analogy. And, you know, how do you ride somebody else's coattails? So Ginger identified some clusters, and we said, what could we possibly be good at in Tooele County? And those were some difficult conversations to have, and it takes time. Because unless you're just going to be a very authoritarian politician and say, this is what we're going to do, you have to go out and poll the people. And just like I said earlier, if you think you're unique, then start talking about tens of thousands of citizens, each one with their own bold opinion, and ask them, so what do you think we could be good at? What do you think we are good at? And you'll no sooner than you start asking a question, start finding that there's very divergent opinion. At some point, though, you've got to coalesce around something, even if it's uncomfortable for some of those folks to hear. And we said, we're going to coalesce around a rich military history, which means we have who here by a show of hands has ever heard the saying, loose lips sink ships? Okay, good. Most of you. Okay, so that's a nod towards confidentiality. You may not know this, but in World War II, Wendover, Utah had a very important role to play. Those pilots that dropped the bomb and won the war for our side, the Allied side, and stopped many more millions of deaths, they, Wendover didn't exist before that military installation was created. 17,000 people worked out there, and the whole idea at that time was it was far enough away from everything that there was some confidentiality and people didn't speak about those kind of projects. So we're like, okay, we've got a military history, we know about confidentiality, we know about the scientific method where you have a very regimented process to change one thing at a time, so very scientific based, and blah, 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 a lot more. So we identified, okay, aerospace industry, that's something we think we can play in, but we're gonna have a tough go at it to compete against Hill Air Force Base. Composite materials is tied into one of those clusters, and we're like, okay, that's kind of the Silicon Slopes of tomorrow, and we started tying ourselves to the Silicon Slopes, and we thought, all right, so what's on the horizon? What can we do that if we're educating a young demographic and we're telling them as parents, we want you to get good grades, we're shifting from an agrarian lifestyle of working the farm or the ranch, and we're telling our kids as parents, this is backbreaking work. You see how hard it is to do. I want you to study and get good grades. I want you to go to university. I want you to learn how to work with your mind instead of your hands. Well, we've done that, and we've educated our kids, and they've taken us, you know, at our word, they go get educated, and then we don't have those jobs back in rural Utah. Fair enough for Santaquin, right? More or less. And that's what we were finding. So we're like, okay, how can we shift that? And we decided we're gonna make a very bold play for the unmanned aerial systems or drones market. And so we created Deseret UAS with some consultation of GOED and Ginger specifically. And I'm really grateful for that because we see that as an opportunity to ride the coattails of state-identified clusters. Silicon Slopes is a separate organization, is over 20 years old, though most people don't recognize it. And we need that talent base that you likely represent a part of, those that are smarter than me at code, to be able to make a machine in the air in three dimensions, make sure it safely delivers a package or a person, believe it or not, and not crash on top of a house or a road below with traditional vehicles, right? So there's plenty of practical and logistical details on how we'll roll that out, but that is something we are actively engaged in. We have a company, an entity rather, that much like Silicon Slopes 20 years ago, its mission is to make sure that we have a place, Tooele County, to not just be centered around mining or a military or 75% of my workforce commuting out to Salt Lake like currently exists. That's a really rough scenario because 75% of my citizens have to go to another jurisdiction to work for a living and then come home and have all the costs that surround it.
Thank you. I'd like to add, when you're talking about envisioning the economy, one of the things our area is experiencing, I mentioned I call it the lunch pail workforce. Get up early, hard work, go to work, come home. One thing I didn't say is a lot of those jobs are very high tech. You may not realize that or think it, but they are very high tech. They're computerized. There's a skill set that, back to the perception, I think our area needs to change its mindset that those jobs aren't just in those industries. You mentioned the agriculture society. I think ours was, for forever, our area was people got out of high school and they went straight to work in the industry making three times the state average wage. Why would you do anything else? Those jobs aren't there anymore, but the technology's still there. The people have the skills. They just need to put them in to apply it in a different format.
When we were talking about clusters, I just wanted to add that the clusters all blend a little bit. You know, they're not really all completely defined. So if you think about it, aerospace has tech. It has cybersecurity. There's all kinds of interwoven aspects to every cluster, and that's basically what Sean was trying to say. And I'd also like to say that it's important in these rural communities to elect the right officials. Commissioner Milne is a true testament to that. A lot of the communities will elect a county commissioner or a county council, and that individual is responsible for economic development, but they've never done any economic development in their entire lives. And so what they'll do is they have a part-time job and then try to do economic development on the side, and it's like drinking from the fire hose. But we were talking about green shoots in communities. right now, the entire world is at a unique place where you can work and start a business from home, and you can be connected, as Commissioner Milne mentioned, to the entire world right from your living room where you never have before with the internet. And the state of Utah has really invested in broadband, and that's been one of the initiatives because that in itself is infrastructure. When you're talking economic development, it really kind of boils down to two things in my mind: strong infrastructure, and that comes in many, many forms, access and workforce. And right now you're at a place where you can work from just about anywhere because of the infrastructure of the internet and broadband, and you can tap into a workforce remotely like you have never been able to before. And this is an opportunity for our rural communities that we have not seen. The internet's fairly new, by the way, and iPhones are fairly new. So this is an opportunity that rural communities can really take advantage of.
Politicians love sound bites, right? Because we know who our audience is, and most Americans have a very short attention span. Sadly, and you may already know this, more Americans have a shorter attention span than a goldfish nowadays, and that's a really sad statement. But they've, whoever those wiser people are, they've studied that kind of thing. And so politicians, I've learned, may be very good at getting elected, but Ginger mentioned something that is so nuanced but vitally important. Just because you know what it takes to get the job doesn't mean that you actually know what it is to do the job well, right? And conversely, I've known some people who I think would do this job, my job, even much better than me, but they don't understand marketing, and they don't know what it takes to get elected, which in and of itself is a challenging element. So we've got a scenario where, what were you just saying? I've already lost my own train of thought going down a rabbit hole.
About working remotely.
Oh, yes. So politicians, I've yet to hear somebody characterize broadband just as succinctly as Ginger has. And it is every bit as important as the interstate program we all take for granted. But before Eisenhower, it didn't exist. It was a loose patchwork of roads across America. There was no interstate. And it was originally conceived, just like DARPANET became the internet, as a military function. The interstate was conceived to get troops and material from coast to coast originally, and now most of us would not even think that was originally what it was conceived for. It's commuters like us. And broadband and the ability to communicate is exactly that. And the way to help bridge some of this gap, and Commissioner Darren Bushman, a fellow county commissioner here in Utah, he is fantastic at preaching this because he's got some initiatives that are trying to help the rural areas, and it requires broadband access, right? So think about some of the jobs either some of you probably work or endeavoring to work in, and that's a way where we can finally start to bring that export scenario back importing to rural America, because if you're working in marketing or PR or law or accounting, you can get access to somebody's books to do their accounting. You can help them with their case if you're an attorney. You don't have to have a physical location, but we need that same kind of infrastructure that the Eisenhower freeway system, aka the interstate system, is that we all take for granted of today. We need that, just like water, sewer, roads, and everything else for economic development. So that's a really important part that politicians sometimes struggle with, because they look at needing to pitch dollars out of a very limited budget to something tangible, that the public wants to see the tangible, because we all take for granted internet access. So it's hard. The very people we need to convince with, we're not having the hard conversation as politicians to tell them why investing in broadband or 5G, as it's going to become, is so vitally important for our rural economies.
I think I'd follow that with, you mentioned broadband, and a case study example. We have a business that started in our area, steel manufacturing. Again, back to very high tech. It's all computerized. It's all engineers designing beams and different metal components. They can do twice as much work in our area, in the rural area, and ship that work to Salt Lake faster than they can get it across the Salt Lake Valley in terms of infrastructure, traffic congestion. And a case in point, they're doing most of the steel at the airport. And a lot of that has to do with broadband access for the plans and the different things it takes to build those components, as well as the physical infrastructure on the ground, roads, highways, and things like that.
That's terrific. Well, you guys just hit on something, and I wanted to I did promise a little bit of controversy in this conversation, because I want to get your reactions to this. So a lot of national economists have laid out sort of 5 points that they think could help rural economies, or at least those that are living in distressed rural economies. And that's first, boosting digital skills, which I think we've covered that. Granting rural firms access to capital. And Ginger oversees a program in the state that is designed to do that. Reducing gaps in broadband, which Utah is actually light years ahead on in most areas. And here's where it gets controversial, and I want to get your reaction to this. Identifying growth poles for regional growth. So in other words, you got a finite amount of peanut butter. Do you spread it on every piece of bread in the loaf, or do you focus that on just a few? And then finally, and this is, I think, the most controversial, helping Americans move to opportunity. So accelerating the decline of some of our rural communities. And I promise some controversy. So there, I've put it out there, and I want to get the panelists' reactions to those, primarily those last 2 points. Investing in specific rural poles and then moving other Americans into major metros.
Well, I don't think that's that controversial. So you're playing it pretty safe. But how many here have heard of opportunity zones? Anybody? Just one? Okay, this is great. So in 2017, President Trump, with the Tax Cut Jobs Act, initiated in his bill this concept of opportunity zones. And it's basically taking distressed areas and low-income census tracts. And in the state of Utah, there's 181 low-income census tracts, and allowing each state to designate 25 of those low-income census tracts. So if you do the math for the state of Utah, that equates to 46. And put those forward to the U.S. Department of Treasury and certify those as an opportunity zone. And what it means to be in an opportunity zone, and Governor Herbert did those here for our state, and there are 19 designated in rural areas. So what that means for rural economies is an investor can defer capital gains taxes for up to 10 years, if you're into the program for 10 years, and invest it into one of these low-income census tracts. And so that is actually a way to, I guess, spread the peanut butter a little bit. But really, this is almost a program that could be too good to be true, where it's allowing investors to put large sums of money into projects into rural areas. And right now we're seeing that play out in mostly real estate. But it has been, it's going to be really interesting to watch how this will change our rural economies and really kind of focus in laser-like fashion.
And I'd got to comment on something that you said about the people driving out of your community. We have both. We have people that leave the community to go to work, and we have people that come to our community to go to work. Each presents a different challenge. And one of the challenges that creates in our area, when you said opportunity zones, is we don't have that many people, and we don't have that many jobs. The jobs we have are really pretty good jobs. By and large, there's a bunch of government. We have Utah State University, cities, the counties, a school district, good jobs, insurance, and benefits. The industry is still there. It's not as many people as it used to be, but they're very good jobs. So it skews some of those income criteria away from the rural area. And some of those programs tend to be a little social in their nature. And so the social side of that falls back on the local community. And everything is more expensive next year, right? So employees cost more next year, fuel costs more next year, everything goes up. Revenues are by and large flat in the public sector in the rural areas at best. Sales tax has been straightened out. There's been a lot on the Hill this year about some sales tax changes. That's what rural communities live on, is sales tax in the public sector. And when everybody buys on Amazon like we all do, and those incomes get out of sorts, you can't provide more. And particularly, we like to think about it's them doing that to us again with those unfunded mandates. But how do you do more with the same or less for the most vulnerable in the community? Because sometimes those numbers get skewed a little bit.
Yeah, this is one of those where perspective is everything. in the Hunger Games, if you live in the main district, like everything's great if you live in Capital City. If you're living in District 13, it's a bum deal, right? You're the peon, you're the servant class for the elitists. I want to be careful that we don't create Capital City kind of paradigms for rural America. Living in one of those right now that is not District 13, I don't want to use the analogy too far here, but 75.6% of my adult age working population commutes outside of our county every single day. This creates, again, this interconnectivity. We need to start socially seeing things a bit more broadly than sometimes politicians will be open about speaking about. And I think sometimes we get a little sheltered because we don't want to hit these hard topics. But folks need to see how they're part of the problem, so they owe it to themselves and their own family units, their communities, to be part of the solution. If you're one of those 75% of people that are commuting out of Tooele Valley every day to the Wasatch Front for work, you're part of the problem of air quality. You're part of the problem of high taxes, because lane miles of concrete road on I-80, that costs a lot of money. But if you can't afford to live somewhere close to where you work, or, as Ginger pointed out earlier, a lot of my citizens love to live in Tooele County. They may be able to afford living closer to work. They live where they do because they want that rural lifestyle for Saturday and Sunday on the weekends, the evenings. They don't want the light pollution. They don't want as many traffic stops, whatever it might be. Is there a way that you can charge a premium for getting what they want when they knowingly are a commuter, adding to our travel cost, travel-related infrastructure? Okay. Now, that's a very pregnant question. I'm just going to throw out like a grenade. I'm not here to address it, but it speaks to this, right? Some of us want to keep rural America rural, which means you knowingly don't want it to grow. But if you come from a traditional agrarian-based economy or lifestyle, you likely have more children per household than somebody in an urbanized area. You may be very part of the growth and the shift. How do we answer that? That's another grenade that's just out there for you guys to debate amongst yourselves. Because guys and gals like me in these positions, again, I work for you. I work for your parents. I work for your grandparents. I'm not here to answer all the questions, but I do think that, contrary to most politicians, I will hold up a mirror sometimes and say, listen, I'm here to solve your problems, but you need to tell me which ones rank at your highest priority and how much of the solution you're willing to pay for. If you want me to give you another lane mile on the freeway and advocate for that funding, it's going to be expensive. I'm fine with that, but I'm going to have to raise your taxes to do it, whether it's the gas tax or whether it's property tax. We can have a question and a conversation about the appropriateness of the vehicle to pay for that cost. But I have to hold up the mirror sometimes to say, if you want that rural lifestyle at night and on the weekends, and you choose to live an hour and a half commute away, that's up to you, and I'll represent you. But you own the responsibility and therefore need to be part of the solution, whether that's through paying for it or recognizing that you're going to have an hour and a half commute, right? So I don't know, to that last point, that I'm for or advocating the capital city approach, where we just continue to export a greater number of folks to an urbanized area, because I don't know that fixes the problem. And again, people will perceive the problem differently, so the solution will be different. What was that second to last point? There's something.
The polls and moving rural Americans into, or making it easier for mobility between rural communities.
Well, I'm gonna attack this. So I think I addressed that last point. I'm gonna attack this part on the polls, or kind of like a cluster. Okay. I believe in the traditional economic incentive model, and this is controversial in and of itself, because right now what we do in this state, like many other states, and you've probably heard about it because there's a fairly popular congresswoman from New York right now who's got a lot of attention on her, and the HQ2 for Amazon deal that got killed there, okay? We have a scenario whereby we incentivize major anchors, and I, to a greater extent on a linear scale, not 100%, but also not just riding the line, support this philosophy, and that's these clusters. Do we spread the peanut butter thinly across everywhere, or do we kind of concentrate it in one place? And I can speak on both sides of this, but I generally adopt to the philosophy of, if you have this major concentration and you've incentivized it, like we're going to take a retail environment here. Okay, let's take a typical 20-acre parcel of land. You've got a growing suburban area, and we're going to incentivize a major anchor to come there. But we're not going to offer the incentive to secondary or tertiary retailers that might come. So case in point, we're going to incentivize Kohl's or Target to be there. And we know, because that's the industry that all of us are in, that there are certain brands that always, always co-locate next to Kohl's or Target, right? We can have, again, we can have the debate, and so I'm somewhat evading a direct answer to Teresa's question, but I'm also admitting that I more or less agree with this philosophy. We'll incentivize the bare 20 acres that Kohl's or Target comes in. They must pay their taxes up front every year, but we'll rebate some of it back for the capital investment they're going to make to bring water and sewer or a road to that 20 acres that right now doesn't have any of it. So they have to make the capital investment first. They don't just get free money, as that congresswoman has couched, you know, $3 billion in cash to HQ2 Amazon. There's not $3 billion sitting off to the side that they were given. They had to perform jobs and investments first. And then there's a bit of a rebate system that comes into effect. How many mom and pop coffee shops or mechanics or the real estate market within a 5-mile radius, you know, what's that multiplier effect, and is that good for the community? We can have a debate, and we probably deserve to have that as much as like Brooklyn would, we should here in Utah, and that's a separate conversation. But I'm more, or, you know, to a greater extent on a linear scale, I'm very supportive of that. Put the peanut butter in kind of a cluster. That's what we're doing with Deseret UAS. It's the stake I've made with the support for the waste management cluster. And, you know, those that have disposable income when they come home at night can spend it with the local mom and pop retailer as a result of it.
I don't know, you had me at Hunger Games because I feel like we live it every day.
Amen to that.
Especially right now during the legislative session.
Yes.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. If you're just joining us, today on the program we are re-airing a panel discussion that looks at the distressed rural economies in Utah, the economic and geographic challenges that constrain their growth, and what those communities can do to revive their economies. In this final segment, panel members take questions from the audience of faculty and students.
So I know the opioid crisis has been affecting a lot of like rural communities, and that also affects economics. And I know there was a special session about how Utah will handle medical marijuana, and that's been seen as a solution for the opioid crisis. From a like a rural leader perspective, what do you think is like the best way to treat the opioid crisis since that affects the communities? Is it supporting whatever medical marijuana initiatives Utah legislature pushes through, or is there something else?
Great question, and the reason I wanted to answer that is our area was ground zero for some of that. I think you find that there's a support for some of the medical marijuana initiatives. Of course, we want a lot of industrial people, they get hurt, they get hooked, you have the problem, as well as recreational. But the opioid thing, man, what a problem. I want everybody to get better from that. But wow, I wish they would not have filed that lawsuit in Carbon County.
So this one hits home for me, with family members specifically that have been hooked on opioids. If I didn't overtly say it earlier, I think I've probably hinted at it enough that I'm a Republican because at county level in the state of Utah, you must attach yourself to a partisanship. If I had my druthers, I would be nonpartisan just like when I was a city council member before. But on many social issues, I'm very libertarian, which means I want you to leave me alone at home. And I firmly believe that as an adult, if I expect you to give me enough respect that I go about paying my bills, living my life, raising my family how I want to, then I need to do the same for you. All right, so I've got kind of a political statement right out there, right out front. As a Republican, though, nonetheless, when it is usually said that Republicans would support big business, I was adamant and very proud to support a class action participation on behalf of Tooele County against opioid manufacturers and distributors. That said, I believe that they have a social compact that if they're in the health profession, just like the Hippocratic Oath would say that you're going to take care of people, I think that they should as well. And if you knowingly, like Big Tobacco decades earlier, know that there's an addictive quality that is upending lives, and this certainly would not have caught them by surprise, you owe it socially to be a part of that solution. I cannot hold up a mirror to my local constituents and say, if you want to live in a rural area, an hour and a half commute away, you need to be part of the solution to create more lane miles. Likewise, business needs to be in the same situation. And again, this hits home. So I've got a family member who has totally upended their life. They've ruined family relationships. They've ruined they've created a criminal record for themselves. And this is someone I love dearly and a veteran. And to think that opioid companies got theirs and then don't see some sort of social responsibility for this in my microcosm of my family, and then to extrapolate it to a bigger, broader community effort, I think is a travesty. You're paying for it whether you're hooked on opioids or not, because as a taxpayer, you're paying for those criminals that, for better or worse, that's the way our society works. We warehouse folks for the time being, and that's not really an adequate way to cure them, to lock them up in a jail at a county level or a prison at the state level and expect that they're going to come out any better on the other side when they're going to turn around and go back to the same social network that they had before. The same people that they had affinities with and affiliating with before is what they're going to go back to. I don't know how to fix that problem. I've only played a small part in trying to say, okay, you guys owe it to society to try to fix it. I don't know that that's a rural and urban divide thing, so I don't think that it's just specific to the panel's perspective today, but that's my very long-winded take on that.
Well, I think that's actually a terrific question to wrap with, because it does, one, discuss why we all should care, right? We can talk about the numbers, the unemployment rate is this, the growth rate is that, but when you think about the real human cost that's an impact, I believe, based on a number of things, but certainly a lack of hope is really, to me, hits home on why we all should care about this and why this terrific group of panelists is working so hard every day to try and make things better throughout the state. So thank you to my panelists. Please join me in giving them a round of applause.
We're wrapping up this forum here. If you missed some of the program or would like to hear the full Q&A section or listen to other Hinckley forums, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.